Welcome to the Blockchain Practitioners Podcast, where we interview founders, leaders, professors, and experts in the blockchain space about an industry which in a few years will affect the lives of us all. My name is Alexandros and I'm your host for today. In this episode, we talk to Violeta Siskina, founder of Female Switch, a realistic entrepreneurial video game for aspiring female founders and entrepreneurs, which teaches them how to use real-life tools, programs, software, and technology used by entrepreneurs every day. This gives them already experiences for each wrong decision they get punished, and for every right decision they get rewarded in cryptocurrencies. In addition, Violeta is the founder of CutChain, a software using blockchain technology to cut industrial design files. Violeta, thank you very much for being on the Blockchain Practitioners Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Alexandros.
It's really nice to have you here. And Violeta, could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. Hi, everyone who's listening. My name is Violeta Siskina. As you can probably guess by my last name, I'm Russian. However, I currently reside in the Netherlands because of my startup. I have several master's degrees, but somehow none of them are in IT. And yet, here I am, the CEO of a tech startup. So some people say that this is weird and strange, but the more I thought about it, the more I realized that it's not that of a surprise because, well, as we say now in CutChain, all the roads lead to IT, and a lot of people who are currently working with me have a very comparable story. There's a lot of girls especially who started with something soft like linguistics or journalism and end up here, because there's always been that interest somewhere deep inside of us when we were kids. But somehow the road that is usually chosen for women, especially in the traditional countries like Russia, yeah, that's not the road that leads to IT directly. But, well, yet here I am. And, of course, if someone asked me 3 years ago, hey, can you imagine yourself as a CEO of a tech startup, I would have said, are you crazy? No, that's not my thing. That's something that I don't like. And yet, here I am, perfectly happy. I think I've never been happier with both work and my personal life. So yeah, life is very unpredictable. And one thing that I wanted to mention is that due to my several master's degree, I'm a very multiple specialist. And I think in the end, that's a perfect combination for a CEO. As you know, as a joke, we say that a CEO is a chief everything officer. So that means that you need to be able to do everything. Well, not perfectly, not at a deep level, but you need to understand a bit of everything. And from that point of view, I think if I go back and take a look at my life, I think, yeah, all the roads were leading me towards where I am now.
No, I will completely resonate with you as well, because if someone would tell me like in July 2020, hey, Alex, you're going to be, you know, into blockchain and into cryptocurrencies, I would have laughed at him. But, you know, here I am as well, I suppose, interviewing people, interviewing startup leaders in startups, in companies generally. And yeah, I completely resonate with you on that. And you're the CEO of CutChain, right? And what is CutChain all about?
Well, CutChain is in essence a legal tech startup, which means that, yeah, we work at the intersection of legal and tech. And it's an early stage startup, even though it feels like forever that I've been doing this. The company has been around for a bit less than 2.5 years when I was scouted by an incubator in the Netherlands. So I came to this country specifically to start my company. We took a look at the country from the point of view of whether it's a suitable place for a startup, and we decided that, yeah, it's not that bad. I mean, one of the most important things is that English is widely spoken, and of course, for a foreigner in a new country, especially if you're trying to talk to businesses, you cannot be expected to learn their national language quickly. So of course, if they don't speak English, that's a problem, which, for example, is the case in Germany. They're not really fond of using English as a business language. So from that point of view, we decided that, yeah, It's a nice place. It's a country of entrepreneurs. They have experience with that. And they understand that you as a startup need to come and talk to them, not to try to sell something, but to do what's called customer development. So to actually try to figure out if you're on the right way, if you're actually tackling a problem that exists or not. And of course, that's what we've been doing. We've been talking to people from engineering and manufacturing, because that's the domain that we're dealing with, and trying to figure out how they were sharing their CAD files. So a CAD file, or in other words, an industrial design file, is a blueprint. It's a 2D or 3D drawing of a product that has to be manufactured. So anything basically that is surrounding us started as a drawing in those CAD programs and was drawn by engineers. And the reason why that CAD data needs to be shared is, of course, if you as a designer drew something, someone needs to produce it, right? Someone needs to manufacture it. And the way it is nowadays is, of course, most of the manufacturing facilities are in China, for example. So that involves data sharing with people who you don't know, because, well, they're located in a different part of the world. Like, how do you share the data with them so that it's not stolen from you? And why is it important for it not to be stolen? Because, well, you've spent a lot of hours, possibly days, on creating something, right? For example, if it's a drawing of an iPhone, imagine how much effort has been put into creating it. You cannot just simply share it with someone and expect that no one's gonna misappropriate it. So that was the problem that we thought was important, and we were right. And that's why, yeah, we're creating a solution that will do just that. It will protect this industrial design, but at the same time, make sure that the design can still be shared.
Mm-hmm. And as I understand it, at least, you're using blockchain, technology as well within the company as well, to facilitate this, the products that you have, let's say, right? And how did you get into blockchain yourself? Because, of course, you said you have different masters and you came into IT. But, well, within IT, you know, like IT is a wide field. You have AI, you have quite different, let's say, specialties. How come you decided, or how did you end up in blockchain in particular?
Well, it was because of the startup. I haven't heard anything about blockchain before. Yeah, of course, I heard Bitcoin, but didn't really care about that at that moment. And because of the startup, because we needed to do market research, that's how I got into blockchain. And of course, being a person who needs to understand in detail what it is that I'm doing, I decided to take all the courses that were available at that moment online. So I took all the MOOCs out there. There weren't that many of them back then. Now there is, of course, a lot more. But back then there was probably 3 or 4, and I took all of them. Some of them blew my mind because they were going so deep into cryptography, which me as a non-technical person, for me that was going back to school and actually studying all these things. And then we realized that, yes, blockchain is being used for certain things. So, for example, as the basis of cryptocurrencies, as we all know. But why not try to use the properties of blockchain technology in a field that is not related to finance? And that's exactly how the idea of CatChain was born, that the underlying technology of blockchain can do so much more than just being used in finance. For example, it can record that, yeah, something happened, who did that, and as you know, this cannot be tampered with, well, ideally. And then, of course, the use case of intellectual property popped up, because that's one of the domains where it's actually important to record who created or who owned what first. So to be able to prove that you are the owner, and that on that day, 10 years ago, whatever, you already were in possession of that file, that's valuable. And seen as the system of intellectual property nowadays is outdated, well, why wouldn't it be? It's been in use for several centuries, right, without actually being fundamentally changed. And it still relies on the premise that prevention is not important, but going after the infringer with lawyers and taking them to court, that's what the system is built on, which, of course, doesn't make sense. Well, probably that was the only way that you could do it back in the day, but now you actually can prevent theft, for example, or not even theft, or misappropriation, right? So your employee can just lose a flash drive with valuable information, and then it ends up in someone else's hands, right? So how can we actually prevent possible theft? How can we make sure that even if someone finds that flash drive with valuable data, they will still not be able to access it, right? We're not going to wait for them to use it, produce counterfeit stuff, and then when we find out, we're going to take them to court. This is a very long and, of course, expensive way. So prevention and control, so these are the two words that started popping up when we were doing our customer development. And this is the part that we use blockchain for. We connect it to intellectual property. If you want, I can go a bit deeper into that to say exactly how we use it. All right, so as I mentioned, there is, of course, this thing that's called timestamping, right? When you timestamp something on the blockchain, and then the timestamp shows at what time certain document existed, right? Because that's the only thing that timestamping does. It proves existence of something at a certain period. Yes, you can try to go a bit further and try to prove possession, using the private and public key pairs. That's fine, but how do you actually prove that you were the one who created that file? And this is where the problem from the legal point of view lies, because one timestamp is not enough to prove creation. And logically, it is the case, right? So if I got a file from you, for example, but you didn't register it with the blockchain, I did, so I'm the first person who officially owns it, and I claim to be the creator, whereas the creator is someone else, you in this case, right? So how do you prove creatorship from the legal point of view? Well, very simple. You have to demonstrate and take anyone through the journey of creating a certain file, which means versions of that file, right? So if you are a writer and you're writing a book, there's going to be several drafts. Same in engineering and manufacturing. If you're drawing something, there's going to be versions that you share with someone, they get updated. And if you timestamp those versions, then the fact that you are the creator is a lot easier to prove in courts than if you only had one timestamp. So that is something that already makes our solution unique, because even big organizations like WIPO, so the World IP Organization, who are getting closer and closer towards using new technology, they're not using blockchain at the moment. They're using the public key infrastructure, which is similar. But even they just propose timestamping of one document, and they say that it leads to a proof of creatorship and that it can be legally accepted in courts. So yes, it can be accepted. It doesn't mean that the courts will say that you are the creator, because you actually haven't shown and demonstrated the process of creatorship. So this is just one little piece of the puzzle that we've been solving. Of course, on top of that, we are using blockchain technology as in combination with smart contracts. And here we use something that we're calling legal smart contracts. As you know, when someone asks what's a smart contract, the answer is it's neither smart nor a contract. Well, in this case, we're actually making them smart and we're making them contracts. So how are we making them smart? They are what we call live contracts. So if you compare it to a piece of paper, right, a paper-based contract that you sign once and then you put it in the drawer, you give it to your lawyer, and it's dead, right? It cannot update itself. So if something changes, or there's another party that gets into the picture, or you need to update the contract, you basically have to either manually create amendments or draft a new contract. So how we're making ours smart? Because they track everything that's happening and they can remind you of certain events that require your attention, and they are able to update themselves. And yeah, it's this tracking and knowing and being in control of everything that's happening, that's what's making the construct smart. And that is also what's making it legal, because in its nature, it is a legal contract. So it's written with a human readable language, but at the same time, it can be read by machines. So it's easy for anyone to understand what the contract is about, because it looks like a regular contract. But at the same time, due to the fact that it's running on the blockchain, then of course you can enjoy all the perks that the technology has to offer. It can be immutable, it can be transparent, it can be whatever you want, depending on the use case. But I must say, it took us quite a while to actually explain to people that blockchain is only a small piece of the puzzle. So it's a small part of the technology that they were using. It's in combination with something else that it provides the most value. For example, with smart contracts. I think a lot of people don't know that smart contracts don't actually need blockchain technology. But when they run on the blockchain technology, it's this combination that actually makes this unique, because then it's a contract that you cannot forge, right? Then it gets the real use case. And that involves, of course, a lot of education. So we have to educate our all potential users, our potential customers, or people who are supposed to finance us. So we have to explain all these things to them, because unfortunately, still even nowadays, when you say blockchain, people think Bitcoin, right?
No, you're educating me as well, because I didn't know that smart contracts can exist outside of the blockchain. But all right, now I do. But yes, and that's also why I have this podcast as well, because I want to show people that blockchain can be used in various fields, in various industries, and it goes beyond Bitcoin. Bitcoin, I don't want to play down Bitcoin in any way. It's a wonderful invention, at least in my opinion. But I think like blockchain as a technology can go far further than that. But I do have a couple of questions for you from what you said. You said that it's legal, like that it's, well, the contracts that you're making, the smart legal contracts are legal. But what I'm just thinking is, I just had this scenario in my head. Let's say something happens. Let's say someone tries to misappropriate the intellectual property of one of the CAD files, right? And then, you have company A that has, let's say, the property rights of the CAD file, and company B who tries to misappropriate them, right? And then these two companies go to the court, obviously. My question is, how would the court react? Because the legislation, I think, is not yet to such a deep level in this kind of technology to take a smart contract, maybe a smart legal contract, and have it as legal. I'm just asking, is it possible for them to see it as a smart, as a normal legit contract, or could there be any problems with there?
Well, let's just say, and we do have a lawyer on the team, otherwise, yeah, we would not be able to call ourselves a legal tech startup, because there's a lot of these things that fall onto the legal domain. And I'm not a lawyer, so I'm going to be speaking, lawyerish gibberish, just in plain words from what I understand. The European system of justice is built on the premise that a judge can accept something as a piece of evidence if it kind of fits certain prescription, let's say. Not sure how to put that correctly. In a sense that it doesn't matter what technology was used, if the proof is there and the judge is convinced, they will accept it. So, of course, it can be a regular paper-based legal contract, which is what most of the judges, of course, are used to. But with a smart legal contract, it's absolutely the same. as I said, it has the human readable interface. So what the judge will see is exactly the same contract. Okay, maybe not printed on paper, even though that is possible, but in its digital format. So it's not different from a paper contract, but it's better than a paper contract, which means, as I mentioned before, if something happened since the contract has been signed to the moment that those two parties ended up in court, all the changes will be connected to the contract. So you can actually track and trace a lot of the events that are mentioned in the contract. And we did have a lot of legal research done about that. We hired an external lawyer. We also had this task given to our internal lawyer. And this is, of course, a constant process of research in the legal sphere. But there is nothing to indicate that those contracts cannot be accepted as evidence. And on the other hand, there is nothing to guarantee that a specific judge accepts that as piece of evidence, because as we know, it's still up to the decision of a specific individual as a judge to accept something or not. So from that point of view, nobody in the world, not us, not anyone, can guarantee that a certain piece of evidence will, with 100% certainty, be accepted as evidence. If someone tells you that they can guarantee that, they're lying. It's not possible. Of course, the best thing that we can do is to make sure that we are creating a legal smart contract that adheres to everything that it's an ideal contract, right, from the judge perspective. And then, of course, we can say that we've done this and this and that. So the chances that this is going to be accepted are very high. They're not 100%. No one can guarantee that. But you cannot do better than that. But another side of this coin is that we actually want to avoid those situations when people have to go to courts. Well, the traditional suing each other, because you can imagine how long it takes and how expensive that is, and how the level, how the field is not leveled for a big company, for example, and a small company or an individual. So if it's a large company that's trying to sue a startup, it doesn't matter where the truth is. The startup is probably going to lose because they don't have enough money to last through that legal battle. The big company will just make sure that those legal fees for the startups are going higher and higher and higher, because just hiring legal representatives for a startup, that's already a huge problem, right? So from that point of view, we are looking at arbitration instead of the traditional taking people to court thing. And that is something that is a service that is already offered by WIPO, so the World IP Office. And we can just incorporate that clause into our legal smart contract, which means when people are signing the contract, they already agree that the arbitration is going to be performed by WIPO. And from what I know, there shouldn't really be a problem with that, because it's a globally known trusted organization on one hand. On the other hand, the process of suing each other, the arbitration, is going to be a lot cheaper, a lot quicker. And I'm kind of also thinking it's going to be online. So that means that a Chinese company, an European company, an American company, they can, in case of disputes, they can do and settle everything quicker, faster, cheaper. And that also levels the playing field, which means that a startup and a large corporation will have similar chances of settling that case.
Mm-hmm. And my next question is about the smart legal contracts themselves. And because our audience are people that are interested in blockchain but may not know, let's say, deep details, could you explain how a smart legal contract works? Let's say you and I, or party A and B, want to have, well, a smart legal contract, right? What are, let's say, the steps from A to Z that they would have to do? And after they have done this, let's say they want party C as well to be incorporated within that smart contract. How does this process, let's say, work from the beginning to the end, let's say?
Yes, like I mentioned in the beginning, I'm not a technical person, so don't expect a technically deep explanation from me. What I like to do is...
No, just high level.
I like to explain it from the use case scenario, right? So what happens usually is that, once again, if it's a small company has to do contracting with a larger company, or there are three parties, as you mentioned, then what happens is that there's a lot of paperwork that goes only in one direction, for example. So it goes from a big company, so from the legal department, towards a smaller company, a startup, and the startup has to sign all the papers just for the big company to have security, because they're the ones who, in case of a leak, lose everything, because the IP in most cases will stay with them. And of course, they have to do their due diligence. However, for example, as you mentioned, when there are new parties added, so if there are freelancers added, or a contract that has to be changed halfway through the project, right? Which means that this whole process has to be started from the beginning, because you cannot amend, you cannot change those contracts in a way that everything that has been changed is trackable and traceable. Yeah, big companies can afford to do this the old way, because that's what their legal department does. They put a pile of documents on the table and they manually go through them with a highlighter, right? That's not how digital economy should work. So what we are creating is a way that, let's say, the smart contract that incorporates all the parties and contains all the information about something, it can continue tracing and tracking if something is being changed in, let's say, subcontracts. So there is a tree. Well, the word tree is popular in blockchain because, yeah, everything is connected and interlinked. So basically it is, yeah, a tree of contracts that can talk to each other, and that's how they can get updated, or they can check if a certain event has taken place and an action needs to be taken. So this is the premise. And of course, that is based on how smart contracts themselves work, which, as I mentioned, I think before, is just a piece of code. And it follows a very simple logic. If A happens, then B happens. So it's the same here, but of course, at a deeper level. And in real life, that is a very big problem, right? So it looks simple. If A happens, then B happens. But in real life, how do we know if A really happens or it was faked? Yeah. In many cases, we cannot know that. Or a different scenario. Okay, if A happened, how do I know that B is going to happen? So this simple logic is actually a big solution to a very big problem, which means that we go back to the idea of prevention, which is what this smart contract does. It prevents something. It makes sure that if A doesn't happen and it cannot be faked, then B will never happen. So we are preventing the misuse of something. It doesn't matter what it is. Of course, it best demonstrates the problem of double spending in cryptocurrencies, that you cannot spend the same coin twice. But it also works pretty well in things like intellectual property, where if one company shared the design that they're not supposed to share with a third party, the IP owner will not only know about it, but they will prevent it. So the third party will not be able to access that IP. We're preventing misuse. We're preventing possible IP infringement and even counterfeit, which, of course, is an idea that... Let's use the word disruptive, even though I don't like this word, but it kind of is. And when we talk to people from traditional IP industry, they say, nah, that's not possible. You cannot do this. You cannot seriously think that you're going to be able to prevent counterfeit. And yeah, because their traditional IP system doesn't allow for that, because it's not built around the premise of prevention. And ours does. So I always tell them, hey, challenge accepted. Talk in a couple of years.
And another question that I had is, you know, like blockchain as a technology, especially in the earlier years, it was not very welcome as well. I think it was perhaps also because everyone connected it to Bitcoin in some ways, and Bitcoin wasn't seen, especially in the early years, in a very good light. When you would go to companies and talk about your solution and about that you're using blockchain, what was their reaction, or what was their take it when you would talk about blockchain in such an early stage of the technology as well?
Yes, that was definitely a problem, not only because nobody knew about blockchain per se, but everyone thought that they knew about it because they heard about Bitcoin and they heard that it was bad. So ergo, blockchain is bad. So that was the underlying misconception in people's heads at that time. But on top of that, the industry that we wanted to create the product in is engineering manufacturing, right? It's a traditionally very... it's a very traditional sphere, industry. They've been doing things a certain way for a long time. They don't want to change. They know that it's not working properly and efficiently, but it is working, and they don't want to change. So, of course, when we started using the word blockchain in the very beginning, and we were big fans of the technology back then, and of course we thought that, yeah, if we just relay how important that technology is to the people, then they will be like, oh yeah, well, now we understand everything. That didn't happen. So in halfway through the first incubation program, I decided to just stop using the word blockchain in our pitch altogether and see what happens. And that's what I did. I just explained what it is we're doing without using the word itself. And I realized that people who know a bit about blockchain, they understand that we're using it without me actually even saying the word. And those who don't understand, for them, nothing is lost because they still understood what we're doing without being scared by this word. So that's what we did for a while. And you kind of have to adapt to what's happening out there, right? So for example, last year, when we were writing an application for a government grant and we had to explain what it is that we're doing in plain language, that was blowing our minds because, yeah, there's only so much you can simplify stuff down. They always say, hey, you have to explain it like you're talking to a five-year-old. Well, I don't agree with that because there are certain things that a five-year-old cannot comprehend because their brain is not developed enough. And the thing that we're creating, the uniqueness of the technology that we were using was so complicated that, yeah, I mean, I'm an educator by one of my degrees, right? And even I was struggling. Like, I know how five-year-olds function, what they think, what their logic is. And, well, maybe I'm a bad educator, but I couldn't figure out a way how to explain it as if it's, something for a five-year-old. But, of course, in the end, we managed. But, yeah, that was hard. And what do we have now? Now there is this second wave of craziness with respect to NFTs. Well, the first wave was, it stayed in the geeky community, never left the geeky ecosystem, as I say, with the CryptoKitties. But this one, it busted out and suddenly the whole world has heard about NFTs. And so I call one of my team members and I say, hey, you know, now in one sentence, I can explain what we're creating, and probably even a five-year-old will understand. Because what we are creating, we're turning industrial design files into NFTs. That's what we're doing, right? Doesn't matter how, doesn't matter what, but this is this one liner that suddenly emerged because something changed and NFTs became a thing that everyone has heard of. However, it's not that easy again. We did a poll to ask our potential users and our followers on LinkedIn if they, A, heard about NFTs, knew what NFTs were about and understood them, or never heard about them. And it turns out that a lot of people heard about them, but not a lot understand what they are. So it's the same repetition of history as it was with blockchain and Bitcoin. People heard about it, and they immediately thought it was bad. Here, people hear about NFTs. For now, I think they think they're good, because they're helping creatives to protect their intellectual property again. But now there is a second wave of negativity, which due to the fact that a lot of NFTs are created on Ethereum, which is still very unsustainable. So there is this negative connotation towards NFTs, that blockchains and NFTs are not sustainable. So you have to really be careful with how you explain what it is you're doing. You have to diversify the explanation for different audiences. So if I talk to engineers, I try to use their language. If I talk to blockchain people, I use their language, right? So it's never one explanation, and it's a never-ending journey. Someone still asks us, yeah, what's your value proposition? We're still struggling with that, just because on one hand, there is so much that we know that we're doing and changing in the industry. On the other hand, yeah, we need to talk to people who are very traditional, so we cannot tell them everything that we're doing because they will not believe it. Well, because a startup doesn't have credibility. That's the thing that we lack, of course. We can be very smart, we can be persistent, we can be innovative, we can be scalable, but we don't have credibility. So if you tell people that you're going to do this and that, they tend not to believe you because, well, you're just a baby company. Yeah. And of course, for that, we have to simplify certain things, not tell the whole story, for example. So for now, the first MVP that we're going to go public with, hopefully this June, is a very small part of our solution. And that's the part that's a plugin for CAD software that protects intellectual property by stamping versions. So this is a very small part of what we're doing. And this is what we're going to already put on the market as a complete product, because we realize that even by itself, it's already a big, a solution. It doesn't even contain the legal smart contract, doesn't even have that part yet, because on top of that, that will already create a massive proposition that we will have even more trouble explaining, because we're going to have to say, hey, it does that and that and that and that. For now, it just does one thing. It protects your IP and proves your creationship. So yeah, I think that is simple enough, and we don't have to use the word blockchain for that.
Mm-hmm. And besides, of course, because I completely understand your challenges of explaining blockchain, because I also come from a background where I'm the only person within, let's say, my friend group that is in blockchain. So whenever I try to explain how it works, I have a really difficult time. And you're doing it even in a deeper level, so I understand that you have even more difficulty explaining it. But what I was thinking is, besides the challenges of explaining blockchain to traditional industries like the ones that you mentioned, were there any other challenges that you had to face, as in, for instance, any other challenges that you, generally that you would have, that you might have faced? I don't want to give any examples, of course. I'd rather listen it from you.
You mean as a startup?
As a startup, yes. That is dealing with blockchain generally.
Yeah, well, as a startup dealing with blockchain, of course, well, as an early stage startup, we depended on government financing, because that's the stage where you're way too early for angels or for VCs, so you have to either self-fund, but eventually your money runs out, so you need to get either subsidies or grants or loans from the government. And of course, that's not a surprise that explaining things to government officials is a skill in itself, right? So you have to show them that there is innovation and potential for the national level in your product. But at the same time, you have to go deep into technology as well, but in a way that even a non-specialist understands. So it's a mind-blowing situation. And I think we are getting pretty good at that, because we've done a lot of those applications, but I still remember the first one. That was a massive headache for me, in a sense that coming from having degrees in different universities, I wrote a lot of papers, and we were pushed towards using academic language, right? So, and then when you write in these applications, it has to be the opposite. It has to be very simple, clear, short sentences, business approach everywhere. So it's a totally different skill. And to unlearn that skill of academic writing and to start writing like a business person, like an entrepreneur, that I had to basically break myself to be able to do that. And the first application took me forever to write for that very reason, because that was, yeah, the unlearning and relearning experience. Then, of course, now I know how to do these things, but it's getting easier to talk to the government in the sense that when we started, blockchain was not in any of the official documents, right? It wasn't in the mission statements. It was nowhere. And now it's everywhere. So, for example, the Netherlands has this, not sure what they're called exactly in Dutch, but the national priority technologies and the sectors. And if a year ago blockchain was not there, now blockchain is there, and not only in one of those, but in a few. So, of course, it's a different situation now when we're creating an application. Now, we're writing an application for a grant. When we say we're using blockchain, we expect that the government is going to understand what it is because, well, they put it there, which, of course, wasn't the case 2 years ago when we were at some point even told, can you rewrite that application and maybe remove a blockchain? And I was like, huh. So I wrote this 20 or 30 pages, and the person who was reading didn't even understand what role blockchain is playing in our whole project. So I was thinking, oh my God, I did a very bad job at writing that. If they think that if we remove the blockchain part, the project doesn't fall apart. So yeah, these are the pivotal moments when you start to question yourself, when you think that you've explained everything properly and correctly, but it turns out you haven't, and you have to think of a different angle. So,
but I don't think it was your fault in the sense that, like, you know, if you look at both sides of the story and from my own experience, right, like in the sense that you know about a blockchain, of course, and you try to explain it as easily as you can to a person or to an entity, obviously, like the government, for instance, that does not understand it. It's really not an easy technology to understand. Like, for instance, with AI, you can at least, you know, like, you can maybe you have an easier way of explaining that. But with blockchain, like when I started, you know, the mock at the University of Nicosia, the first 2-3 weeks were really difficult in the sense that you have to learn a lot of stuff that is completely new to you, and you need a mind shift as well from the centralized way of thinking to decentralized, for instance, right? So I think that's also something that a lot of people do not yet understand. So maybe that was also like, well, that's maybe a reason of the challenges that you faced as well.
Yes, definitely. I would even put it in a different way. When people don't know something, it's easier to explain it to them from scratch. But when they think they know something, that is very hard. Because then you don't explain to them, you try to convince them and change their opinion. And that is one of the hardest things that you can do. So if you have a person out there who thinks that blockchain is bad, because they heard that Bitcoin is bad, and they assume that blockchain is the same as Bitcoin, and they don't even take you seriously when you start mentioning the word blockchain. They just, you know, stop listening to you because they're like, ah, nah, not interesting. Not going to deal with those scams and cryptocurrencies, all of that. So you have to actually convince them that no, this is not what we're doing. That's the part that, that is very frustrating. I would rather just explain things to people from scratch. And we actually did that once we were invited to a meeting of Design Association, one of the provinces, and I did the blockchain 101 for them. I'm not sure if they understood what I wanted to say, but at least, they now know that it's not about that. That it's not about only cryptocurrencies. That the underlying technology itself is there and cryptocurrencies are just one of the use cases. The most, probably the most, the easiest one, probably. That's why it became popular, it was put out there. But there are other use cases, and I tried to demonstrate that even in the traditional engineering world, the use of blockchain can be beneficial, because there are so many things that they do where they need to have, let's say, to have different versions of the same truth, if we're talking about version in CAD data, right? And they need to know, for example, which version is the one at the moment. And that is complicated, because if you send your files by email, then you have no idea who has what version. You have no idea what is going to be sent back to you, because if they change that, so it becomes very massively messy very quickly. So even that one little problem can already be solved with blockchain, because I don't know, if you put a unique identifier to each version and you show that to everyone, you say, hey, we're using version with this unique identifier, that's all. So then it becomes clear, right? Of course, you can go deeper and put other types of technology on top of that, for example, to prevent people using any version other than that. Then it makes things even easier. So they try to open the file says, I'm an old version, don't use me, use another one.
I see. And, you know, we also discussed, of course, that in the past you had difficulties of explaining of what you do and also the reception that you had. But now throughout the years, you were founded, if I remember correctly, in 2018, or at least that was when the idea came up about. Do you see, like, from 2018 to 2021 now, have you seen generally people being more open to this technology? Like, maybe there isn't a KPI to measure that, right? But from your own experience, from how it was in 2018 to 2021, do you have the feeling that it becomes at least a bit easier?
Definitely. It definitely becomes more popular, and the technology is being used by the government as well. So one of the towns here in the Netherlands is now using their own cryptocurrency to reward citizens of that municipality for doing some communal work. So that one project already shows me that, even the government is taking that technology seriously. It still makes me sad in the respect that it's still only being used in the financial sector, so it's still currency related. But I'm assuming that, it will take a bit longer until even the governments realize that, there are so many more use cases for that. And also recently, a football club here from the Netherlands introduced their own token, their own award token that is to be distributed between the fans. And there it goes a bit further than just financial rewards. It goes more towards voting rights for things that are not extremely important for the club, but for example, for choosing what kind of a bus to buy for the team, then the fans are happy to decide and to vote on these things, right? And then, of course, you can put all other things on top of that. You can put NFTs that, I don't know, the autograph of a football player that is, given to the fans and so on and so forth. So there are all these things that possibly blockchain is not essential for, but I'm happy that it's still being used in this project, because it gives popularity to the technology. Yeah, that it's not just something for something that happens far, far away in the Bitcoin community. Yeah, no one understands what it is and what is being done there. They know it's scary, but here it's already happening. Here it's used by a local municipality. It's used by a local football club. So all of these things are, of course, showing me that there is positive change. There's a tendency towards, I'm not going to say mass acceptance of the technology, but at least it's given a chance, let's say. And we are trying to participate in as many conferences as possible, where we're talking, for example, about blockchain and intellectual property. And we get responses like, huh, wow, I didn't even think about that. So people are beginning to realize that, yeah, it makes sense if it does that and that. If, for example, there is this immutability, yeah, why does it only have to be used in currencies? It can be used anywhere where immutability is needed, right? So you try to expand their horizons a bit. And I'm also happy that the European Union, the government, is also putting money into blockchain. So, for example, Catchain has been chosen to participate in a Horizon 2020 spin-off. So it's an incubation / grant for blockchain startups at the European level, right? So it's specifically only for startups that use blockchain. And it's not the only one. So I know of a few of them already. So that is also very good and positive news that these kind of startups are being subsidized. We've also participated recently in the AI and blockchain validation lab. So it's a semi incubator from one of the universities here in the Netherlands. So there are these things that are popping up here and there. Once again, I must say it's usually in the fintech sector. So we still have problem of explaining how what we're doing actually relates to blockchain and engineering. People still don't understand that. And I think that is, it's no one's fault, let's say, because these are the two topics that are massively complicated. So blockchain or any new technology and legal aspect, right? So there's not really many people or startups or companies that understand how intellectual property rights works, right? And if you put that is already a massively complicated topic, and you put that on top of blockchain, another massively complicated topic, and then you put that in the domain of business to business in a traditional industry, so that difficulty quadruples, right? And then you have to deliver the one sentence value proposition. And if anybody who's listening has an idea on how to do that, to deliver all that value that we're creating for this huge and massive sector in one, you're definitely hired. Yeah.
The episode with Yoleta was so interesting that we kept talking and talking and talking, and we lost complete sense of time. As a consequence, we ended up with a 2-hour episode, and instead of releasing everything in one batch, we decided to keep to our normal duration of every episode, and thus we're going to release this episode in 2 parts. This is the first part. Stay tuned for the second.